No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. Tonight, we have a very interesting show with a very interesting guest who's going to talk about a very interesting person who was a great force of activism in America. But first, I want to say a few words about our show the week before last, where we had a TV crew in here.
Maria, right, because you only mentioned it sideways, and I thought, this is really exciting, and I'd like you to let the listeners in behind the curtain.
Well, you know, it's exciting because people are getting more interested in statehood. God bless California, Maria, who's been had so many co-signers and is also talking into dividing into three states, which is upping the conversation. Just this week, I've been asked to speak in Ohio on the issue. I was asked to speak before the Congressional Black Caucus on the issue. And I just got an email today. There's a group of students coming from Germany, and they want to interview me because part of their project in coming over here for 2 weeks was to pick a subject to study, and they want to study D.C. statehood. So, whoa. Yeah, so they said they were fascinated at the idea because they knew nothing about it. So when they did a little research and found out what the situation was, they were fascinated by it, and they wanted to do some research. So they're going to interview me. But so the word's getting out there and the movement's going forward. We have 195 co-sponsors. So a local TV station, Channel 9, the CBS affiliate here in Washington, decided that they wanted to do a long piece on D.C. statehood. And as part of that piece, they were intrigued by the fact, Maria, that you and I have a radio show where we talk about this, among other things. So they came in and they filmed the radio show. They actually filmed me sitting there talking to you and the audience about statehood and our guest, Denise Jenkins. And they're going to put together a piece, which this is going to be part of, that's going to be on the local CBS affiliate in the next couple of weeks. We don't know exactly when it's going to be yet, but they're still working on it. So
that's really
what's going on.
When you get that information, you can let us know, and then we can also log on and download it after it's aired.
Absolutely. And we'll get it on YouTube, and we'll put it on the BBS radio app online. And, yeah, we'll get it all over. And, but this is what's going on. Things are just starting to happen where more people and more people are getting interested in this. And they're calling, writing, and letting us know what's going on. So it's very exciting.
So it feels like there's momentum to me.
There's momentum.
And you've been at it for quite a while. So I know you've got more than ever, but do you feel like the conversation is getting more significant, more meaningful, that you're attracting a wider audience, that it's not just
about
the citizens?
That's the key. We're attracting a wider audience. And that's the important thing because, you know, we've talked about this many times on the show that we've done polls that show that most Americans are in favor of us. By most, I mean 80% of Americans, regardless of party affiliation, are on our side about having an equal voice in our national legislature. So, or in the national conversation and having full representation. So our problem really is that 80% of America believes we already have that representation. So by getting a wider audience, we're letting people know this is not the case. And this will lead to more activism. And that's really what we need, because if we could bestow statehood upon ourselves or equal rights upon ourselves, we would have done it 200 years ago. So yeah, we're getting a wider audience, and that's important.
And then that leads us then into why we have our guest and the topic and the event that's happening next month, where people can get involved and can get some skin in the game by contributing to the cause.
Right, absolutely. We have decided that we are going to have our first event at Arena Stage, which is a big theater here in Washington, D.C., and we're going to have an event. And the event revolves around a play by about the life of Dick Gregory. Now, Dick Gregory, for those of you who might not know, was a social activist and comedian of the highest order. And this play is about his life, and it's getting great reviews.
Is this where it debuted, Michael, or has it been traveling?
Where it debuted, and okay. It was put together by John Legend, by the Will and Jada Smith, Pinkett Smith Foundation, and by a bunch of other luminaries who know how important this man was in the history of the civil rights movement in Washington, and wanted to produce the play. And the New York Times says it's scorchingly funny and brilliant, and that it takes your breath away. And I just got an email from Dick Gregory's son. We've involved the family in this. And Dick Gregory's son went on the opening night and said it just blew him away. You know, it was thrilling and sharp and intellectual and white-knuckled thriller. Opening night was awesome. It shattered my expectations. So we encourage you to come and see this play and be part of this. We're going to throw a party after the play, a reception, and Friday, October 12th. And the reason we're throwing a party is it happens to be the occasion of Dick Gregory's 86th birthday. Now, Dick passed away last year. He passed away right before his birthday. So nothing really was done much in public to celebrate his birthday, because his passing was just before that. Had an amazing memorial service. But we're going to do this, and we're going to have this reception, and you should come. It's going to be a glorious event. And let me tell you the kind of luminaries that are going to be there. Maria Sanchez is coming all the way from California.
I am. I'm going to fly in just
and
for
let
this.
Let me tell you, the meager $100 ticket price, which is only $5 or $10 more than regular orchestra seats, and all our seats are in the orchestra. They're the best seats available. That ticket price is worth the price of admission just to meet Maria. I would pay twice that much to meet Maria. And so you should come, because it's going to be wonderful. And we're going to write.
But then there's the party afterwards, because as you said, he was born
afterwards.
On October 12th.
We're going to have a cake that's been baked by a bakery here in Washington, which is owned by veterans. It was started by Iraqi War veterans, I believe, who wanted to do something positive and train people. And they're going to make us a special cake. And we're going to have champagne, and you're going to get to meet people that knew this man. His son, Christian Gregory, is going to be there. We think his daughter, Ayana, is going to be there, and a lot of really cool people that knew him, Joe Madison, who has a nationwide show, and others. We're trying to get others people there, maybe even the star of the show. It's a one-man play, and we're going to invite him and hope he'll come. And right now I want to invite Professor Edward Schmidt. I know you're all the way out in Wisconsin, but if you have time, we'd love to have you too, Professor. So let's first welcome you to our show. Thanks so much for being on.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, for those of us that don't, I've been lucky enough to know Dick and members of his family through the work I do here in Washington. He was a strong supporter of statehood, which is one of the reasons that we're coupling this all together as a tribute to him and to promote our foundation that works on statehood. But for those of us that may be listening that really don't know him, that are younger, maybe weren't around in the 60s, 70s, and 80s when he was a big deal. Can you give us a brief biography of him?
But let's preface that, Professor Schmidt, by saying why. Oh, why are we asking you these questions?
And I should say that. I'm sorry. Professor Schmidt is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he's writing a book about the life of Dick Gregory. So maybe that's where we should start. Why a book?
Yes. Exactly.
That's a great question. My wife asked me that once in a while. As the process has taken a while, it's been an amazing journey because he's an amazing figure and someone whose life and work really is woven through the last half century of American history in ways that are sometimes kind of funny because people may know one part of Mr. Gregory's career and not the others. There's some people that aren't aware that he was basically the Jackie Robinson of stand-up comedy in the early 1960s, the first African-American stand-up to have the opportunity to perform at the elite clubs in the country. His breakthrough was at the very first Playboy Club in Chicago. And then he became really the hottest entertainer in the country, basically, in 1961, and was a household name throughout the rest of the 60s as an entertainer. But then he used that influence and threw himself basically into supporting the civil rights movement. And not just in terms of using the spotlight, which he did do, but he was there on the ground marching with people all over the country. So that was kind of the next phase of his public career. And then he ran for office a couple of times. He ran for mayor of Chicago against Richard Daley. He ran for president in 1968. So he really was a household name. Everyone knew who Dick Gregory was. As time went on, he kind of found new ways to remain an activist and kind of get his message out. He spoke on college campuses all over the country. I think, Senator Brown, you said that you had seen him speak when you were in college.
Yeah.
And I hear those stories all the time from people. It's something that really hasn't been captured nearly enough, that kind of that part of his life was huge through the 1970s and beyond. And he also became a well-known advocate for health, people looking out for mm-hmm. how they ate, questioning what their diet was, looking at ways to eat more naturally, that was a huge part of who he was. He remained an activist throughout his life and threw himself into causes that he saw as worthwhile. He was an early supporter of Native American rights, an early supporter of women's rights, the anti-war movement. There was no more devoted leader and participant, the anti-nuclear movement. I could just go on in terms of the kind of movements for social justice that he was really at the leading edge of. And then in the 80s, go right ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say he was a family man too, that he had a wife of almost 55 years and 11 children.
Amazing how he was able to remain such an incredible father and family man. That's right. It's another part of his story that I'm just trying to wrap my mind around all the time. How did he do all of this? And obviously there's nothing more important than that. So an amazing figure that way too. And then he was stemming from his interest in diet, he became a weight loss expert. Maybe you remember that in the 1980s and a little bit beyond that.
The Bahamian diet. Well, that was his,
But interestingly enough, when he was diagnosed with cancer, he refused Western medicine and resorted to his health and wellness regimen, and it did go into remission. You know, chicken or the egg, you could argue, but never, I still think that's pretty inspirational. He walked the walk. They didn't just talk it.
You really, that, I think that kind of sums him up right there, Maria. Somebody who put his principles first and really put his life where, you know, his message was, exactly.
Well, you know, I'd just like to comment on that a second, because the last time I saw him, you know, this is exactly who he was. And he always talked truth to power. We had a breakfast that I saw him speak at, and this was an Emancipation Day breakfast. And in Washington, D.C., we celebrate Emancipation Day. It's our only official holiday. And Emancipation Day for the district, for those of you that don't remember, is the day that Abraham Lincoln bought 4,700 slaves and set them free as a prelude to the Emancipation Proclamation, about 8 or 9 months before the Emancipation Proclamation. So we celebrate it, and we also use it as an occasion, since we don't have the same rights as other Americans, to highlight that. So we had a breakfast, a statehood breakfast, and he came, and he was one of the speakers. And there were maybe 200 luminaries in the room, the mayor, members of the city council, you know, your typical people that come to this. And we all got up and talked about how wonderful we were and how the ball was going forward. And Dick Gregory stood up and said, "What are we celebrating?" He said 150 people in a room talking about how great things are when 700,000 people are denied their basic human rights, their basic civil rights. He said, "We should have a celebration when 150,000 of us are together and talking about this." But 150 people, he said, "Get out there and do something. We need to get this work." And that, right? And that's who he was. It would have been so simple for him to just go along, but he didn't.
How was that received, Michael? Did the room just like...
Yeah, got quiet.
I would imagine.
You know what I say, people started looking at their shoes, you know, because they knew that he was spot on. And that's another thing about him. When he came to my little white college in suburban Washington, lots of us didn't know who he was. He left us breathless. I mean, really, we had tears coming out of our eyes. He made us laugh so hard. But when he left the stage, he also left us with a message and something to think about. And he was just, please comment on this, Professor. Wasn't that really his genius, that he could do that?
It really was. I mean, so many people that I've read about and had the good fortune to talk with have said, you know, he was the most compelling speaker that I've ever been around. And it really struck me when you said how quiet the room got, because I've seen that numerous times. You know, in recent years, the final phase of his public life, for a lot of young people, they know him as really a wisdom figure. Maybe they only know him through internet interviews, but that's obviously a very powerful medium, and that's what we're using right now, right? And trying to reach lots of people, and you do. So he could make people be very quiet and listen and learn. But at the beginning of his public life as a comedian, he made people very comfortable, and that's kind of what was called for at that stage, comfortable enough to think about the injustices with regard to race in the country through laughing about them, but also then, you know, thinking about it and questioning it afterwards. And so throughout his life, he could do both of those things. And how many people do we run across who have that kind of gift?
Right.
Most don't. Because they go into comedy to make people laugh and entertain them, not to make them socially aware or socially conscious or socially ashamed, which he was able to do without people feeling like he was pointing the finger at them. It was more of a collective experience. But people couldn't help but laugh, because comedy is truth at the bottom. And if it's not true, that's why we don't laugh. So the fact that he could bring that up and into the conversation, and as you mentioned earlier, he crossed audiences and was attracting white people. Jack Part, of course, didn't hurt when he was able to sit on the couch as the first black performer to do so up until that point. I mean, there's so many barriers that he broke through, and he did it insightfully. He did it without being hurtful, and he did it with wisdom and obviously talent.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, and I can tell you that and correct me if I'm wrong here, Professor, because you're the expert, but he exuded a certain kindness. You know, we in politics, we always value those people or admire those people that have a personal touch, that make you feel like you can go up and talk to them or have a beer with them or shake their hands. You know, the Bill Clintons, the Ronald Reagans, the, you know, people that have that ability to just come off as a regular person. And you know, and certainly Dick Gregory just had that in more quantity than anybody should, I think. And he was always exceedingly kind to me. And you know, I think that in general, people felt that about him. You know, I read somewhere, and I think this is true, that the main thing that determines whether you like somebody or not is whether you think they like you. And Dick Gregory liked people, and you could tell it from the minute you met him.
That's good. Can I use that for the book? I like that. I think
absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely, because that's the way I felt about him, is that, you know, he liked you. He didn't have an axe to grind with you. He had an axe to grind with society, maybe, or the way things were run. But on an individual level, he just liked people. And, you know, and let me tell you, it shows in the children that I know. Now, I don't know all of his kids, but I know a couple of them. They're exceedingly warm and kind and generous people themselves.
So true. Yeah, you mentioned Dr. Christian Gregory. I wouldn't be on this journey that I've been on without him being so supportive of wanting to have his father's life story told in a, you know, really thorough historical way. And you just couldn't ask for a better person to help facilitate what I'm trying to do. And yeah, one of the great memories I had when I had the opportunity to spend 2 days interviewing him 2 years ago, we took a break for lunch and walked down the street, and just seeing people in D.C. come up to him and you know, want to get pictures. And yeah, that magnetism and that personal touch was a huge part of who he was.
Well, and he was so approachable. You know, he wasn't pretentious. He didn't have an entourage around him. I'm sure you realize this when you walk down the street. It was you and him. You know,
right.
It's not like he had an advanced person or, you know, or he would show up at an event with a bunch of people. He was, you know, you saw he was what he was. And that's another thing that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Maria, because you're such a good people person. But I think the single most attractive thing about any person is somebody that feels comfortable with who they are. And Dick Gregory certainly felt comfortable with who he was.
And also who listens.
Yes.
They don't have to be front and center. They don't have to be the funniest person in the room all the time. They don't have to be in the spotlight all the time. It can be a conversation. It's not a monologue. It can be a give and take. And that's what I think he exuded as well. You mattered too.
Right. And you know, he understood he was the funniest guy in the room to begin with.
Right.
So he didn't have to prove it to anybody.
Yeah, but a lot of comedians feel like they have, you know, they're only as good as their last joke. So keep in mind. You know, Professor, since you teach African-American history and ethnic studies at the university level, can you put what his accomplishments were in context in the whole scheme of things in that regard historically?
Yeah, and that's, I always, as I kind of get fascinated by the details of his life over decades, I find myself that I, you know, needing to kind of pull back and look at the big picture regularly so I don't get lost in all that. And I think, you know, he was really a pivotal figure in two of the most important developments of post-World War II American history, one of which was the emergence of modern popular culture, which we just kind of swim in it today. We take it for granted how important television and the entertainment world and kind of the sharing of information is. But all the technology of TV was new, and how, you know, the idea of water cooler conversations, talking about what folks saw on television last night, that was just emerging in the 50s and 60s. And he was a key figure in that when he went on the Jack Parr show and was the first African-American stand-up to really have an extended exposure along those lines. There were some, Nipsey Russell was on Ed Sullivan once in the 50s, and there were others too, but he really was the first to become a household name. So he was really, really historically important for that. And then he was really important to these movements for social equality that start to come out of the recognition in the 1950s that, okay, things look really good on the surface, but there are a lot of people that are left out of this. And so he will throw himself into the Black freedom struggle and become one of the, you know, really most visible faces of that. And how many people he educated about that, how many people he inspired, how many people he motivated, it's kind of unquantifiable, even though I'm trying to gauge all that. You know, how many ordinary, normal people like us did he move to get involved? One quick story. I interviewed an individual who saw Dick Gregory speak at University of Wisconsin back in 1963. And he was he's white, and he was from a working-class neighborhood in Milwaukee. And he wasn't particularly politically involved at all, but after seeing Dick Gregory speak, he was so enthusiastic about trying to help that he became one of the handful of volunteers from Wisconsin the following summer who went down to Mississippi during Freedom Summer when the three civil rights workers were killed, and it changed his life forever. And so how many lives were touched like that, I'll never be able to wrap my mind around all of it, but to try to document some of that is what I'm trying to do.
And I assumed, and I apologize for this, because since he passed away in August of last year, that you were coming at this work posthumously. But this has been in development. As you mentioned, you got to meet him and speak with him while he was alive. What brought you to this man as the subject of a book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've written just one book so far, and at the tail end of the research for that, it was about Robert Kennedy and the issue of poverty in the country. And at the end of my research for that book, I was looking at a lot of African-American newspapers from the early 60s to kind of see how African-Americans viewed the Kennedys, and I kept seeing all these stories about Dick Gregory, and I knew that he was, again, basically the Jackie Robinson stand-up comedy, but to see all the places, and he was just sort of omnipresent in those years, and the pride with which African Americans wrote about his integrity and how, you know, how he was involved just was compelling to me, and I just kind of started following the trail, and I saw that there hadn't been anything published really about him in a book-length form, and just it's been kind of a trail that's been endlessly fascinating ever since that beginning.
Well, let me tell you something. I think you're on the right track here, Professor, because I think there is there's a real hunger for this. This show that we're talking about, that we're inviting people to, they're selling tickets right and left. I mean, it's just open. It's only been open 2 days, and there are already three nights that are on the verge of selling out. There's only a couple tickets left for those three nights. So, you know, evidently there's a lot of people. Now, this was one of his hometowns, Washington, D.C. The other one was Chicago, as you've mentioned. But, you know, I think there's a real hunger out there to know more and more about this man. Can we talk a second about how brave he was? Because, you know, he went on these incredible hunger strikes, right? Doctor, very, very long. I mean, and this was a man that was, you know, I don't know, 130 pounds soaking wet anyway. He wasn't very heavy. You know, he was a skinny guy his whole life. But he went on these long hunger strikes. Can you talk about those for a minute?
Yeah. So when he first was kind of exploring aspects of diet, and culture in the 1960s, he met a woman named Dr. Alvina Fulton in Chicago, who owned a health food store and was an expert on kind of natural diet and fasting. And so he learned a lot from her and was fascinated by it. And so he thought that he would combine that with using the spotlight that he just naturally generated at that point in his career because of his celebrity status. He thought he would combine kind of exploring what he was learning about fasting with making a statement, basically a social protest through fasting. And there were other figures around those years that did that. Cesar Chavez went on a fast, several fasts, but his first fast began around the same time. But Dick Gregory really was first. And so the first long fast, just water, that he went on was to protest the Vietnam War. But he pretty much was almost on a continual close to fast through the next probably 12, 13 years. There was one stretch, I think, between 1972 and 1974 where he didn't eat any solid food at all. And so remarkable what he put his body through, again, as a matter of principle.
Yep. And as you mentioned, it wasn't just an isolated incident.
No, not at all. And he really became an expert, obviously, through through experience. And in the early 1980s, I don't know if you remember the tragic end to the hunger strike of Bobby Sands, the Irish activist. Dick Gregory went to, and was invited over to Ireland to kind of help to educate potential fasters there who were kind of heading down this road, because he knew that, you know, there are ways that you could, it was very dangerous if you didn't do it right. And so he went to Ireland and shared his knowledge and shared his support.
Well, that's another thing that you learn very quickly about him when you get to know him a little bit, is that he was a sharer. He was somebody, you know, who truly believed that if you cast your bread upon the water, it returned to you tenfold, because he was constantly doing that. He was constantly reaching out. He was constantly talking to young people. He was trying to engage people. And, you know, when you talk about his running for office, we should point out that this man didn't run for, you know, like city council or local commissioner. He ran for the mayor of Chicago.
Dog catcher, yeah.
Yeah, and he ran for president of the United States. And he did them both to make bold statements about race in America, I think. Is that true? You think that's why he did it, Professor?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, I don't think he was under the illusion that he was going to win the presidency. He might have thought that he had a chance to shake things up more in Chicago, but really, you know, you couldn't have picked two more powerful leaders in the world, really, in the mid to late 60s than Richard Daley and Lyndon Johnson. And for him to run and put himself, you know, in harm's way, saying some pretty tough things and sometimes highly justified criticisms of those leaders, was pretty remarkable. Yeah.
And also strong Democrats. I mean, when you talk about strong leaders, they were also strong Democrats. So he took on the party that African Americans supported most during that period of time. And so that made it even more difficult for him. If he had taken on some people that were in the opposition party, that may have been a little easier. But he, you know, he didn't shy away from a challenge. He said that, you know, he made that statement that Daley was, you know, not the right person for the job, and that he stood against the war in Vietnam and therefore against Lyndon Johnson, and didn't really care about their party affiliation or anything else.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think that's another, again, so much about his life and message, and sadly, you know, how much work we still have to do with regard to inequality in this country. So much of it is timely. And one of his consistent messages was, I mean, he was not a political partisan at all. He thought that the system was messed up. So he, you know, he criticized Democrats and Republicans with equal opportunity when it was called for.
Well, and interestingly enough, as you mentioned, his quotes that he's infamous for, they do skewer. You know, it's there's not a partisan. He even said, which he didn't like the term and the N word, because he said we need to expose it for what it is and how it is. And it was included in the title of a book that he wrote, spelled out. And he wanted people to address the hard, cold, ugly realities without sugarcoating it or sidestepping around it, which I think is also admirable. And I also, one of his quotes was, I never believed in Santa Claus because I knew no white dude would ever come into my neighborhood after dark.
Right. <You know? Yeah>. Right.
Well, and he said a lot of things like that. And you should know at his memorial service, which was unbelievable, the people that came to his memorial service. I mean,
where was it held?
The rich and powerful. It was held at a gigantic, maybe the biggest church that I've ever been in, and I can't remember the name of the church.
But in D.C. or Chicago?
In D.C., no,
okay.
In D.C., in a black church that had gigantic video screens and room for a choir of like 300.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
It was so massive. And his nephew was one of the eulogizers, and he's a stand-up comedian. Oh. And the first thing he said, he got up there to eulogize his uncle, and the first thing he said is, hey, does anybody have a feeling that these people have too much money? And everybody laughed, because it was right. Like, yeah, it was like, oh my God, you know, this is such a big thing. But it was standing room only. There were luminaries, there were political figures, national political figures, and you know, all sorts of people there that knew him and loved him. And, you know, I just went, they're making a film on his life. You know, this professor, somebody's doing a film on his life. And it, yeah. The Washington, in D.C., there was a film festival for social justice. And they showed part of the film, you know, part of the film
right.
That's being made. And one of the people there was an old friend of his who we've invited to our event. I hope he comes. Rock Newman, and he told the joke that actually Joe Madison told the joke that he was one of you know, his favorites. And he said he was on a plane flight with a friend of his one day, and the pilot got on the intercom and said, look, we've got a problem, one of the engines is out, we're gonna have to lighten the load, so we're gonna throw out all the luggage. So they threw out all the luggage, and then he got back on and said, unfortunately, that wasn't not enough, and we're gonna have to start throwing people, asking people to jump off the plane and sacrifice themselves so that the plane will be safe and we can land and save the other people. He said, and we're gonna do it in alphabetical order. So he said, first, will all the African Americans please leave the plane? And Gregory said, his friend stood up and he said, shut up and sit down. And then he said, no African Americans? The pilot said, okay, well, all the black people on the plane, please stand up and leave the plane. And again, the guy went to stand up and Gregory said, no. And he said, okay, no black people? Well, all the colored people on the plane.
Oh, my gosh.
You know,
I thought you were going to get to Caucasian next.
And the guy went to stand up again, and he took it, Gregory, and he said, if we're not African Americans and we're not black and we're not colored, what are we? And Gregory said, today you're a Watusi. So, you know,
or Zulu. Was it a Zulu?
Oh, Zulu. No, you're right. Today you're a Zulu. I'm sorry. I screwed up the joke. Today you're a Zulu. You know, and, you know, he wasn't afraid to confront things head on like that and make fun of it and in a way that I think was acceptable to everybody. I mean, he certainly made the crowd laugh that night. Yeah,
so,
I can't believe
Professor
I'm...
Smith, if you don't mind, I'm going to let Michael have a little sidebar here, because it's the event again is to help raise money for
The Statehood No Other Way Foundation, which Dick was a big statehood supporter, and it's really more of a fundraiser, more than a fundraiser. It's a way to introduce this new public interest group to the Washington civil rights community, because we didn't want to have just another dinner where we stood around and we talked about how wonderful we were and the progress we were making, because the image of Dick Gregory comes back to me saying, what are we celebrating when we get 100 people in a room together? We should be celebrating when we get 100,000. So that's our goal, is to figure out a way to get 100,000 people on the West Lawn of the Capitol. And to help fund that effort, the Statehood No Other Way Foundation is sponsoring this event and tickets to the show. And we'll post all this information on the BBS website for anybody that's interested in going to the show and getting tickets. But if you're in the Washington area, I encourage you to do it. And you do it by going to statehoodnow.org. Statehoodnow.org, because that's the website for the foundation. It's the Statehood Now Foundation, Statehood No Other Way. So statehoodnow.org, and you can buy tickets, and we'll post all this. And you'll have a great time. This is going to be, you know.
It's a fundraiser.
Yes, it is a fundraiser.
So again, it's Friday, October 12th at the Arena Stage, but you don't go to their box office. You go to statehoodnow.org to buy the tickets.
And that way, you also get to go to the reception afterwards, where we're going to throw a birthday party for him, and you'll get to meet people that knew him, people that are related to him, people that have known him for years. It'll be an really, really interesting event. And you know what? The regular box office tickets sell for as much as $95. So, you know, for orchestra seats. And all our seats are in the orchestra. So for an extra $5, you get to come to a reception, pay homage to this man, and meet people who knew him and loved him. And, you know, so I hope you'll come.
Which is, and it's called Turn Me Loose is
Turn
the name.
Turn Me Loose is the name of the play. And you know why it's named Turn Me Loose? Do you know why, Professor?
I do. Yeah. Do you want me to answer? Do you, or did you?
Yeah. No, you go ahead and answer.
Yeah. So Medgar Evers, the great civil rights leader from Mississippi, was really probably the most instrumental figure in getting Dick Gregory involved in the movement. And when he was shot in front of his own home in 1963, basically those are the last words that he said, that he sort of, he knew the end was here and his work was done, turn me loose. And so that's where the phrase comes from.
And you should know that he has a connection to Washington as well, as he was driving our delegate in the House of Representatives, Eleanor Holmes Norton. He had just driven her to the train station and returned home when he was shot, Medgar Evers.
Oh, wow.
And you know, I think it's such a great title for the play, because, you know, Dick Gregory himself was a very spiritual guy and, you know, and very inspirational, and they couldn't have picked a better title for the play, in my opinion. And, you know, and it just shows you the kind of respect that people had, you know, that John Legend is involved in this, and that Will and Jada Pinkett Smith. Obviously, there are people out there, especially in the black community, especially entertainers and celebrities, that understand what an important role this man played and how important it is, and how important his role was. And I hope that the play, which starts here at Arena Stage, will end up going forth and be produced in other cities as well.
Well, it had a Broadway run in 2016. It actually was fairly successful, but I think this iteration was also made possible via Howard University.
Yes.
So there's a lot of bright minds that collaborated to make this happen in D.C. And I think it's, what a privilege for you, that Michael, that live there, and an honor for me to be able to attend from the West Coast, because I wouldn't have, it would not have been on my radar had you not.
Well, you know, and I think maybe it's not on a bunch of people's radar, but it should be because this was an amazing guy. Let me ask you, Professor, you said he was the first in so many ways. What do you think? Did he open the door for Colbert and John Oliver and Stewart and people like that who today have made a whole career out of this kind of, I don't know, what we want to call it, antisocial comedy or social commentary? Did he open the door for those kind of people?
He definitely played a very major role. Yeah, he was kind of part of the stream of other, back then they called them topical comedians. And so Mort Saul, starting in the 1950s, and Lenny Bruce,
Lenny Bruce,
he didn't
yeah.
get entrance to all the same clubs because he pushed the envelope in many ways. But yeah, Dick Gregory was right, you know, in that first rank of those kind of comedians. And again, another way that he's so timely, I mean, so many of us now look to satirists like the Colberts and other folks for their interpretation of the news because we have a sense they're going to cut through the BS. And so, yeah, Dick Gregory was very much at the heart of all that.
But more so predating them, Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, they followed him.
Right, and all of them give, you know, nothing but credit to Dick Gregory for being the first and being the one that had, you know, kind of opened the doors and went through the challenges. He the respect that he has among, you know, Dave Chappelle and other contemporaries.
Exactly.
Chris Rock,
I was going to say, and Kevin Hart, and yes, Chris Rock, and even the actor whose name is escaping me. I just had him. He started on Saturday Night Live.
Eddie Murphy.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Just drew a big fat blank there.
Yeah, that happens.
You know, those that observe, observational comedy, if you will, but also culturally significant and politically aware, because there are others, too, stand-ups that happen to be female as well, that happen to be different kind of ethnic groups that are doing it well, too. But I would I would say that you know, somebody, because when you mentioned Mort Saul and Shecky Green and even Don Rickles, or they weren't political per se, they were more humorists. So
Mort Saul was—he really was the first to be very political. But even Saul wasn't necessarily partisan. He sort of criticized everybody, but he was the first to really kind of go right from the newspapers with things. And another interesting point that you just made, Maria, is, you know, how many of our great humorists and satirists come from ethnic groups, or it's crazy to say genders that have been marginalized, but it really is the case that people who aren't kind of in the positions to dictate and hold power have maybe the keenest observations about what's not right in society.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you think, Professor, that the environment has changed in such a way? Would Dick have been as popular today if he started today? Sometimes, and the reason I ask this question is sometimes I'll watch Carol O'Connor and the comedy that he did through All in the Family, which was a groundbreaking TV show. And I wondered if you could have a show like that today, because it was so, you know, it was so over the top in so many ways that this man played kind of a decent but uneducated racist that we all knew. We all knew somebody like this guy, right? And we were able to laugh at that. Would we, the way the country's divided today, could we laugh at those things, you think, anymore?
I think that we could, and we do. I think what's different now is just how many choices we all have. So people, I think, aren't forced to maybe confront a Archie Bunker character that you just kind of go watch the channels you prefer to watch. So they don't have the kind of the national attention and stage the same way that maybe it was back then. But back to your question, could Dick Gregory have made it today? I think there's no question. I mean, the reality is a lot of young people only know him, like I mentioned before, from interviews he's done recently, and the combination of his humor and his wisdom, you know, attracts young people now. But the other thing that I'm just continually fascinated by watching his life evolve and kind of reliving it with him is how he adapted to whatever situations he was in, and his humor and his ability to draw people to him was just there all the way. It changed over time, and it kind of fit different situations and different circumstances, but he had that it factor that I think was timeless.
Well, yeah. And as I said too, though, comedy is truth. So regardless of it being the 50s or 2018, if it's true, it's funny.
I think, even though it hurts sometimes. Yeah, I think that's true, Maria, but I think we've all gotten so sensitive about things. You know what I mean? I worry sometimes about that we're, you know, that political correctness has gone to the point where it's obscured our ability to laugh at ourselves. And I think that's important. You know, that we need to see ourselves as fallible. We need to see ourselves as human. And if we don't, we have a harder time realizing the problems that we actually have to confront. So I worry about that sometimes. But Dick, yeah, I agree with you, Professor. I think his humor really is timeless. And it really touches us all as individuals. So, Professor, let me ask you, because we're running out of time here, what questions should we have asked you that we didn't ask?
Oh, that's a great question.
What do you want to tell us about?
I got a good one. Your book finished, and when can we read it? And I'm sure your wife asks you that too.
That's right. That's maybe the most important question. Yeah, I'm moving as quick as I can. The thing that is wonderful and challenging is the more I learn, the more I want to know, and the more people that I come in contact with that have stories, they'll refer me to someone else that I need to talk to. And so kind of being able, again, to sort of distill things and keep my eye on the big picture. But I'm hoping I'm almost halfway done writing, and the momentum is picking up. So I'm hoping soon, maybe Christmas 2019. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, and that's the great rabbit hole of research, right?
Yeah.
The more you know, the more you discover what you don't know, and then it's just limitless.
It really is, and with all the digital access, I mean, I could go on newspaper databases and just kind of dive into almost any day and learn you know, so much. So it's a wonderful thing, but it presents its own challenges too.
So I would imagine, since he spent time with you personally, that he sanctioned your work.
That's a great question. I think I can feel confident in saying that, because I've continued to work with Dr. Christian Gregory, who's the executor of his estate and had been his business manager also, that he was very supportive of it. And it was amazing to be able to be in the room with him and just talk after having read about him and looked at videos and pictures for years, really, before that point. And so it really added something that would be missing, I think, if I didn't have that opportunity to really kind of be around his spirit. And so I'm hoping that helps to make the book, you know, as good as it possibly can be.
Well, I'm sure it will be, and I'm sure it'll be fascinating. And I thank you for being on the show, Professor. And I want to invite you to our event. If you want to come, we'll certainly make room for you and make sure you're there and you get to see what's going on. If you can squeeze us in on October 12th, please come. I know it's a long way to go, and we're gonna. I think we're gonna film it. So if you're not there, we'll certainly get you the footage. And again, we appreciate it. And I hope you'll come back soon as the book progresses, and talk to us again.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. Same here.
Yes, because you added a nice level to the conversation to support statehoodnow.org. And again, Friday, October 12th would have been Dick Gregory's 86th birthday. Yeah. And so it's so poignant, Michael, on so many levels and compelling, not to mention a fantastic production. So,
yes.
Yeah, there's all kinds of reasons for this to sell out quickly.
Yes. And you know what? We're going to leave you tonight because the name of the play is Turn Me Loose. We're going to leave you with a favorite Washington musician who's a favorite son of all of us. I'm sure that Dick liked him too. And we're going to play a song called Bustin' Loose by Chuck Brown. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, America.
Give the people their right to vote.